For this episode of Tax Justice Warriors, I will be looking at currently not collectible status and the local standards available on the IRS website that you can use to figure out currently not collectible status. Thank you for tuning in to Tax Justice Warriors.
Welcome to Tax Justice Warriors, the podcast that celebrates the work of low-income taxpayer clinics, focuses on tax controversy work, and looks at related issues in tax news. I'm your host, William Schmidt, the director of the Low-Income Taxpayer Clinic at Kansas Legal Services.
On this episode of Tax Justice Warriors, I am looking at currently not collectible status and the local standards used for determining currently not collectible status. This is part of the series of classes I am teaching regarding tax procedure at Washburn University School of Law. And I did go more in depth on these topics in episodes 8 and 9 of Tax Justice Warriors. If you want to hear a longer review of these topics, this will be a bit of a introduction to the topic, not necessarily too in-depth, but I'm going to go over the 433F form and talking about the local standards available on the IRS website. So to begin with, currently not collectible status allows for the IRS to put the collection activities on hold if an individual has more expenses than income. They will check on an annual basis to see if the individual's income situation has changed. If it has not, then it will stay in the currently not collectible status, and it could do so until the 10 years for the collection statute expiration date has passed, and the IRS basically writes off that debt to no longer be collected. Now, as another item, some people get a little leery about currently not collectible status if they are owing a debt larger than $10,000, because the IRS will file a notice of federal tax lien. I will get into the notice of federal tax lien more when discussing collection due process, but just so you know, that is something that would happen that may cause a client to be leery about currently not collectible status, but I do find it as a good stepping stone to first getting the collection activities halted, and then second, seeing if you can get the client into an offer and compromise. Overall, first, stopping the stressful activity with the IRS, and then second, getting that debt removed for the client from the IRS. Now, the first step is getting the client's information. If you are submitting paperwork to, say, a revenue officer, they would prefer the 433A form. That is roughly 5 or 6 pages, and that would be if you are, say, faxing that over to them. But often, to get a client into currently not collectible status, this can be done over the phone, and I prefer using the 433F form. This is 2 pages, and it generally contains the same information on the 433A. It's just easier to manage. So the general information to get from a client is their assets, income, and expenses. Now, going through on the assets, I will just briefly go through. They list them alphabetically, so A is accounts and lines of credit. For low-income clients, this is generally just bank accounts, but they do list several types of accounts that you might go through, such as retirement plans, stocks and bonds. There is a large list, so you can go through that with a client. B is real estate. So for low-income clients, they generally may just have one home, but you do want to go over this with your client to see just how much real estate they have. Now, when going through the assets that usually is not an impediment to currently not collectible status, but could be an impediment when going over the offer and compromise, so I will discuss that in a later episode. C is other assets. These are generally vehicles, but it lists cars, boats, recreational vehicles, whole life policies. So usually for low-income clients, this is one or more cars that is being listed. D is credit cards. And this can wind up being an issue if your client has several credit cards that they are paying on and you are trying to get them in a situation where they are not paying the IRS. So I think you can understand the IRS's position that why should a taxpayer be paying on their credit cards and not pay anything to the IRS? They are looking out for the IRS best interests in that case, but you are getting the type of credit card, the credit limit, balance owed, and minimum monthly payment. So eventually an argument would be that the taxpayer could max out their credit card in paying off the IRS. But again, this is more of a concern for an offer and compromise rather than currently not collectible status. If this person is self-employed or runs their own business, E is for business information. F is for employment information. So you are gathering the information from their pay stub, finding out how often they are paid, what kind of taxes are withheld. And then G goes through non-wage household income. So this has a list including alimony, child support, self-employment, rental income, unemployment, pension, interest and dividends, social security, and other income. Now, last we turn to H, monthly necessary living expenses. And there are several categories. The first one is food and personal care. The second relates to transportation. So either public transportation or car expenses. Three is housing and utilities. So rent, phones, cable, internet, and all kinds of utilities that may be connected to the home. Fourth is medical, health insurance, and out-of-pocket healthcare expenses. And the fifth is a long list of other expenses. So these can include expenses related to a job like union dues or retirement, also student loans, court-ordered payments, and other categories. Now, a person on their own would fill this out, and it would be easy to go over the IRS limits in those categories. But they do list local standards on the IRS website, and a person would not know about this unless they do actual digging on the IRS website. So you could put in local standards on the IRS search tool and find these from the different categories. Now, they do revise these standards at the end of March every year. So if you're listening to this soon after it goes up in February of 2020, coming up soon, there will be revised local standards for the year. Those standards are based on government data, and I did investigate some of that a little bit, that the category of out-of-pocket healthcare seemed low, but that was data that the government had gathered, so I didn't know that there was much argument to make the case for that. But going through, for example, housing and utilities, that is set out by state. And then within each state, that is then divided by county, and you can look up the family size, one person, two, three people, etc. And filling out the form, you would see that that is the maximum amount allowed for a family to total all of their housing and utilities. Next, turning to public transportation, there is a national standard. Ownership costs of a car, That is a national standard for one or two vehicles. Operating costs, this is divided out by region. So for operating one or two cars, I turn to the Midwest region, and that includes Kansas and Missouri, the two main states that I most deal with. National out-of-pocket health care, this is divided out by whether a person is under age 65 or 65 and older. Now, this one is the first of the different limits because the rest of them, that is a limit that you are not allowed to go over, that if you are trying to go over, then you should have documentation. But for the national out-of-pocket health care, this is one of the ones that they will allow the maximum, and you do not have to show any kind of proof. The second one is national standards for food, clothing, and other items, and they have standards for one person, two people, three, four, and more than four. I would read off dollar amounts, but they're going to change soon, so I don't know that that is worthwhile. And often, when I am filling out the forms, I am just using their actual amount and not going over the limit. Though with something like out-of-pocket health care, especially for people 65 and older with several medical costs, I can see why it is worthwhile to go above and beyond the limits set by the IRS. So using those standards, you can determine to keep your client within the boundaries set by the IRS, that they are more likely to be qualified by the IRS by submitting something within the boundaries and the limits that are already set. And what I find is that it can work to call it in, get the person qualified, and the IRS will send out the qualification letter to the client and to me, since I am copied on their correspondence. And for some clients, that is acceptable. That is all they were needing. Other clients, they want peace of mind or to settle with the IRS. So I find that it is a good starting place to get them set up so they are in a good negotiating place to begin with the IRS, and we can more likely qualify them for a low offer in that regard. So having the ability to gather a client's information for currently not collectible status is essential. That can lead to eventually those debts expiring or having a settlement through an offer and compromise that leads to peace of mind and will help deal with quite a bit of the clients that you are working with. I'm not sure if it is half of my clients, but it is a good amount of them who are needing collection assistance. So this is a major tool in working with the IRS to help the clients to move to a better situation in working with the IRS and dealing with their issues. So hopefully this is helpful to you. If you're wanting to hear more of my talks about currently not collectible status, I would refer you to episodes 8 and 9. Thank you for tuning in to Tax Justice Warriors.
Thank you for listening to Tax Justice Warriors. We have a Patreon page if you'd like to support this podcast. Providing monetary support for this podcast helps with expenses like equipment or travel to tax conferences. Supporting this podcast through Patreon comes with rewards, so check out our Patreon page. Please rate or review this podcast because positive reviews help get more people to know this podcast exists. The views expressed on this podcast are not official opinions of the IRS, the Low Income Taxpayer Clinic program, or the employers of the people who spoke on this program. Your tax situation is unique, so do not take the statements on this program as tax or legal advice. Consult with your own tax professional to provide you with specific advice on your situation. Tune in next time on Tax Justice Warriors for another interesting tax discussion.